I'm going to concentrate on one statement that was written down, and it was a statement that really intrigued me. And I'm going to deal with a word this morning as a part of forgiveness that nobody really came here for, and that was not put down on the paper. And the phrase here, I want to learn to be able to forgive freely and easily. And the word that I want to use this morning and focus on is the word pain. Pain. To what extent is there forgiveness apart from pain? And what do most of us do with pain in our lives? I'd like to share a few words with you from a book. And if you ever get a chance to read this book, I highly recommend it to you. Gentlemen, in the back row there, I appreciate your participating in the program, okay? The name of this book is The Road Less Traveled, and it's written by Scott Peck. And this book, to me, was full of a lot of wisdom. He starts out this book by saying, life is difficult. That is a great truth, and that is one of the greatest truths. Most people do not fully see this truth that life is difficult. Instead, they moan more or less incessantly, noisily, or subtly about the enormity of their problems, their burdens, and their difficulties, as if life were generally easy, as if life should be easy. They voice their belief that their difficulties represent a unique kind of affliction that should not be and that has somehow been especially visited upon them or their families or their tribe or their class. And he says, I know about this moaning because I've done my share of it. Life is a series of problems. Do you want to solve them or do you want to just moan about them? And then he makes another statement in here that the tendency to avoid problems in life is the number one cause of mental illness. The tendency to avoid and run from pain in life is the number one cause of mental illness. He said, when we avoid the legitimate suffering that results from dealing with problems, we also avoid the growth that problems demand from us. It is for this reason that in chronic mental illness, we stop growing, we become stuck, and without healing, the human spirit begins to shrivel. He says we need to do four things in life. We need to learn what it means to delay gratification. That means you need to learn what it means to live so that you don't say, hey, I want that, and I want it now, and I get it now. You need to learn how to wait. And that's really tough in our society because we live under the theme, you know, fly now and pay later. And credit cards. Why, man, I'll pay 18% interest on my money if I can have it now. And I got, you know, you see people stop and they flip out a whole series of credit cards. I want it now. A second thing he said we need to do is take responsibility for our own lives. I don't care who you are, I don't care where you're from, at some point in your life, you have to take responsibility for your own life and not blame other people for who you are or what's happened to you. And if you don't, you're in big trouble. You take responsibility for your life. And the same thing goes for these sessions or this weekend. Now, somebody leaves this weekend and says, man, that was a drag, or man, that was nothing, or man, this and that, and man, this and that. And the first thing I would say to that person What responsibility did you take for your learning this weekend? Don't blame me if you didn't get anything out of it. You take responsibility for your life. The third thing he says is dedication to truth. What's the truth? And a fourth thing is balance in living. Now, this might be words from an old man, but life is not just fun. It's not all fun. Now, I could take this book and I could show that to every single convict in the Washington Correction Center and say, these are places where you're stuck, friend. Because these guys see a car sitting out on the street, and they say, I don't want to work and make payments on that car. I want to get that car. I'll hotwire that car, and I'll take it, because I want it now. I don't want to wait. You know that 90% of the people in prison are there for drug or alcohol-related problems? 90%. 90%. Do you know that just about without exception, every woman in a woman's prison has been an abused child? You know that? You can take the family histories of guys in prison, and you see either psychological in most cases, sexual or physical abuse, and they become abusers. You talk about the forgiveness factor. But we have a tendency in our society to run from pain. I get very frustrated when I'm sitting there watching TV, and on the TV comes the old sign, you know, the guy with the headache, or, man, this is an Excedrin headache, okay? Or when life got tough, what happened to Excedrin? Excedrin got tougher, right? People start popping aspirins and taking Excedrin and extra heavy-duty Excedrin. Do you know what your body is? Your body is a finely tuned, fantastic creation. Absolutely fantastic. And your body absorbs everything that happens in your environment. And your body feeds back to you what's happening in your environment. If you get a headache, your body's saying, something's out of sync someplace. You better stop and take a look at how you're living and what's happening to you. And start taking a look at your lifestyle and your life, because your body's saying something's not right. But what we want to do is say, I don't want to listen to my body. I'll take care of it, take a painkiller, and move on. Same thing with ulcers or stomach problems. Your body's saying, I don't feel good about how my life's going. Back problems, you name it. It's amazing. It was just amazing to me in working in the prison to see what people do to get away from problems and pain. Mondays and Tuesdays in the prison are the easiest days in the prison. You know why? Why do you suppose Mondays and Tuesdays are the easiest days in the prison? Huh? Anybody have any ideas? Huh? What's that? Somebody said weekend. What?
That's when the visitors come.
All right. Why is that a big thing when the visitors come on the weekend? Right. All the pot comes in on the weekend. Monday and Tuesdays are mellow days because all the pot's in and the pot's used. You know how pot gets into the prison? Anybody know? Yeah. Okay. Comes in through balloons. You meet your girlfriend in the prison. She might bring the drugs in balloons, and she can bring them in. They bring them in body cavities, vagina, rectum, okay? Go to a restroom, come out of the restroom. They can have that balloon in their mouth. They'll kiss their boyfriend in the prison. He'll take the balloon. He'll swallow the balloon. He'll go down to the hall. He'll crap in the toilet and pick out the balloon and get the drugs. You think people aren't clever in their ways to get drugs? Used to have guys come up and tell me, hey, chaplain, there's nothing wrong with that. Man, you got to get high in prison. It's terrible being here in prison. Had a couple of guys come up and see me and say, hey, chaplain, I want you to know we're high because we want you to see how cool we are when we're high. and how we get help when we're high. And I mean, they were like a couple little kids, but they thought they were really figuring everything out because they were high. And if you got the bag, or if you're the dope man in the prison, you got it made. You got it made, because people come to you. There was a guard in the prison who brought drugs in, and in 6 months he could buy himself a new motorcycle. Now, this is at a prison where you can't have any white money on your body in the prison. You can't have white money in the prison. But they get money and they pay for drugs because they don't like the pain of prison. The tendency to run from pain. If you know the forgiveness factor, you know pain in your life. Now, take responsibility for your own lives. There is a really funny story here. It's about a guy who was a sergeant in the military in Okinawa. And he had an alcohol problem. He was a career military. And he was referred for a psychiatric evaluation. And he said, he's no alcoholic, nothing wrong with me. And he says, the only reason I drink is because there's nothing else to do in Okinawa but drink. And the psychiatrist said to the guy, well, do you like to read? He says, yeah, I like to read. He says, well, why don't you read in the evening instead of drinking? Well, he says, it's too noisy to read in the barracks. Well, why don't you go to the library? Well, the library's too far away. Well, is the library further away than the bar you go to? Well, I'm not much of a reader. That's not where my interests lie. Well, do you like to fish? Yeah, I love to fish. Well, why don't you go fishing instead of drinking? Well, I have to work all day long, and you can't fish at night. Well, there is fishing at night. I know several organizations that fish at night here. Would you like me to put you in touch with one of them? Well, I don't really like to fish that much. Well, what I hear you saying, the psychiatrist says, is that there's other things to do in Okinawa except drink, but the thing you like to do most in Okinawa is drink. Yeah, I guess so. But your drinking is getting you into trouble. So you're faced with a real problem, aren't you? Hey, man, this damn island drive anybody to drink. He's not responsible for what he does. It's Okinawa that's doing it to him. One of the worst things that happens to a person, and one of the things that I told the guys in prison that's so deadly, is when I don't take responsibility for my life, and I live my life out of a sense of self-pity. Poor me. And why doesn't somebody come and help poor me? And when I wait for that, I am totally immobilized because I don't take responsibility for my own life. There's something I need to share with you. It says this. It's written by John Gardner. Human beings have always employed an enormous variety of clever devices for running away from themselves. And the modern world is particularly rich in such stratagems. We can keep ourselves so busy, fill our lives with so many diversions, stuff our heads with so much knowledge, involve ourselves with so many people, and cover so much ground that we never have time to probe the fearful and wonderful world within ourselves. More often than not, we don't want to know ourselves, don't want to depend on ourselves, don't want to live with ourselves. By middle life, most of us are accomplished fugitives from ourselves. Well, I'd like to talk about the forgiveness factor today, and I'd like to do that in the context of the Bible. Bring your Bibles. Open the Bible to Genesis.
People need Bibles. There are Bibles on the bookshelf. Raise right.
Yeah, if you don't have a Bible, go grab yourself a Bible. We're going to spend some time in a couple of stories in the Bible here.
Huh. I thought, those pencils are retracted.
Yeah. They're over in our room. Pick them up yesterday.
You mind if I go grab them?
Not at all. Okay.
Just grab one, please, and hurry back down so we can get moving. And when you get your Bibles, turn to Genesis chapter 25. Are they all out over there? Okay, we're going to talk about the forgiveness factor in families, and we're going to look at the story of Jacob and Esau. And I think the story of Jacob and Esau relates to the story of a lot of us. We'll begin with the 19th verse, and I'll read this out of the Jerusalem Bible, and you follow along in your Bibles. Now, this is the story of Isaac, the son of Abraham. Now, you identify with this story as we go along. I'm sure you'll find some ways of identifying with it. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel the Armenian from Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban the Armenian. Isaac prayed to Yahweh on behalf of his wife, for she was barren, and Yahweh heard his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived. But the children struggled with one another inside of her, and she said, "If this is the way of it, why go on living?" So she went to consult Yahweh, and he said to her, "There are two nations in your womb. Your issue will be two rival peoples. One nation shall have the mastery of the other, and the older shall serve the younger." And when the time came for her confinement, there was indeed twins in her womb. The first to be born was red, and as though he were completely wrapped in a hairy cloak, and they named him Esau. And then his brother was born with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so they named him Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old at the time of their birth. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skilled hunter, a man of the open country, and Jacob, on the other hand, was a quiet man, staying at home among the tents. Isaac, the father, preferred Esau, for he had a taste for wild game. But Rebekah preferred Jacob. That ever happened in any families? One boy is the mother's favorite. One boy is the father's favorite. Now, who in the world in the family gets the blessing? Did you ever hear about the birthright syndrome? Which child gets the father's blessing? Which child gets the mother's blessing? How do Jacob and Esau interrelate as siblings in a home? Where's the forgiveness factor? Where's the conflict? Where are all these things taking place, not just in the family of Isaac and Rebekah, but in my family, in your family, in everybody's family? Now, what goes on? One time Jacob made some soup, and Esau returned from the countryside exhausted, and Esau says to Jacob, "Hey, let me have some of that red soup. That red soup there, I'm exhausted." And then the name given to him, Edom, because Edom means red, and he ate red soup. And you know what Jacob said? Ah, he's no fool. He says, "Brother Esau, you're the oldest, the firstborn. You're the one who naturally gets the birthright." He says to his brother, "Sure, I'll give you soup, but give me your birthright first." Nice brother, huh? And Esau says, "Hey, man, I'm standing here at death's door. What good's my birthright to me? You got a deal. Give me some soup." What did we talk about in our opening remarks? Immediate gratification. I want the soup, not the birthright. And then Jacob says, "Give me your word, your oath." And he gave him his word, and he sold his birthright. And Jacob gave him some bread and some soup. Nice family, huh? Family that Christ came from. And then he says, that was all Esau cared for his birthright. You know what the word Jacob means? The word Jacob means deceiver. Deceiver. But you know, it kind of comes back. You know what happened to Jacob? Well, I got to get into this. This is just a great story. Turn to chapter 27 in Genesis. Now here, Isaac is an old man, and his eyes are so weak that he couldn't see. I don't suppose they had glasses in those days, but old Isaac couldn't hardly see a thing. And he's old, and he hasn't got long to live. And so he says, I got to give my blessing to my boys, or to my boy. And he says to his oldest son, Esau, he says, my son. And Esau says, I'm here. And he says, Esau, I'm old and don't know when I'm going to die. Now you take your weapons, you take your quiver and your bow, and you go out in the country and hunt me some game. You make me the kind of savory I like, kind of good gravy. Bring it to me that I may eat and give you my blessing before I die. Now the plot thickens. The mother is standing outside the room listening, and she hears what's going on. And Rebekah says to Isaac, or Rebekah says to her son Jacob, I just heard your father saying to your brother Esau, bring me some game and make some gravy for me, and I'll eat and bless you in the presence of God before I die. Now, Jacob, you do what I tell you. You go out to the flock, you kill a couple of good lambs, and I'll make the kind of gravy that Isaac likes, and then you take it to your father to eat, and he'll bless you, and he'll think you're Esau. Holy smokes. And Jacob says, I can't do that, because if I go into my dad, he can't see me, but he's going to touch me, and he's going to know I'm not Esau, because Esau's all hairy, and I've got smooth skin. And she says, yeah, I'll take the skin of the animal and put it on your arms, and he'll think you're Esau. So Jacob goes in and meets with Isaac. In verse 18, he presents himself before his father and says, Father, I'm here. And the reply was, who are you, my son? And Jacob said to his dad, he lied. He said, I'm Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told me. Please get up and take your place and eat the game I brought you, and then give me your blessing. And Isaac says to his son, boy, you did that fast, Esau. I thought you just left. And then Isaac says to Jacob, come here. I want to touch you. I want to touch you, my son, because I want to see if you're Esau or not. And Jacob came close to his father Isaac, who touched him and said, the voice is Jacob's voice, but the skin is Esau's. And he said, are you really my son Esau? And he replied,
I stop by.
And he got the blessing. Lied flat out in his dad's face twice. Then Esau comes home and he says, hey, Dad, I'm here. Here's what you asked me to do. He says, well, who in the world are you? I just gave you the blessing. They figure out what happened. And then you jump down to verse 41 in that chapter. And Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him, and thought this thus to himself, the time to mourn for my father will soon be here, and then I will kill my brother Jacob. In other words, my dad's soon going to die. As soon as he dies, I'm going to kill my brother. Now, Jacob is an interesting guy, because he obviously, at this point, what do you think Jacob does? What would you do? Huh? What? What would you do? Hang around ready to kill him? What? Yeah, he sweat. I gotta get out of here. You know what he did? He went and stayed with one of the friends, the brother of his mother. You know what happened to him there? It's a really kind of interesting story. He meets this girl named Rachel, and she's beautiful. He says, boy, I gotta have Rachel for my wife. And he talks to Laban, and he says, I wanna marry your daughter. Laban says, that's okay. He says, but you got to work for me for 7 years before you can marry my daughter. He says, okay, I'll do it, because I really want that one. they've been for 7 years, and then comes the big wedding ceremony, and the wife is in the back of the home there and so on, and comes in with her veil, and Jacob's standing up front. 7 years he waited for Rachel. He's coming down the aisle. Oh, this is a big day for him. And he stands up, and they make their vows, and they're married. And he takes the veil off, and holy smokes, it's her older sister, Leah. You didn't get it. You know what Laban said to him? You work with me another 7 years, you get Rachel. He says, I want Rachel, I'll do it. And this Jacob and Esau, or Jacob and Laban, cheated each other all through the whole time. And you know the mist of benediction, the Lord watched between me and you while we're absent one from another? You know what that really meant? It was Jacob and Laban talking to each other when they left and saying, man, God keep his eye on you until we meet again. You trickster. And so now you've got Jacob coming back home to meet Esau. He's going to meet his brother. What do you think he's thinking? Huh? Going back home to meet his brother. And Jacob's a clever guy, and so he says, well, I got to meet Esau, and I've got all these flocks and all these slaves and all these animals and all this stuff. And he says, I'm going to divide it up. I'm going to have a group here, and a group here, and a group here, and a group here. And now when you get to Esau, you say to Esau, when he asks, who are you? Say, this is from your brother Jacob, and he wants to give it to you as a gift. So Esau will meet this first company and say, who are you? Well, this is a gift from Jacob. He'll meet the second company. Hey, this is a gift from Jacob. He'll meet the third company. Hey, this is a gift from Jacob. And by the time he gets to Jacob, what's he going to say? He's a nice guy, isn't he? This Jacob is thinking all the time. And so he's got this all planned out. And so he goes to meet his brother Esau. And that night, he leaves all of his wives and his families and his possessions over there, and he crosses the river. And he's all alone in this river, by this river. You know what happens to him? He wrestles with God. He wrestles with God. All night long, he wrestles with God. You know what happens after he wrestles with God? He rests the rest of his life. Now, don't you ever think that you're going to wrestle with God and not be changed and in some ways crippled. Because God's strength is made known in weakness. And God said to Jacob, he said, you know what your name was? Your name was Deceiver. But now your name is going to be Israel, protected by God. We're sitting here this weekend. We're asking for a weekend. For a weekend, what? 2.5 days to build community. You've got all kinds, not all kinds, but you've got some rules about what community is, right? Any deception in this community? Any deceivers in this community? You want to build community? If you want to build a community, that means knowing what it is to be community. That means a change of name, a change of life, a change of purpose, a change of heart. You don't build community freely and easily. Forgiveness is definitely 100% free, but never say it's cheap. Never say it's cheap. And when there's deceit in community, the whole community suffers. In my history, in my life, I believe that I was my father's favorite and my brother was my mother's favorite. And that affected my whole life. When I got married, I was awfully sure that I was always, I was never going to let my wife dominate. And I was so afraid that she was going to dominate me like I perceived my mother dominating my dad, that I wouldn't even listen to her. And I had to deal with that. I had a lot of anger toward my mother.
there'd be all busy getting the house ready. Everybody'd be a nervous wreck by the time company got there, you know? Wish company never came. And I never understood until I was about 38 that my mother struggled for her father's blessing and her older brother got the blessing. He was the favorite in the family. And her older brother continually put her down. And so my mother was always trying to impress her older brother with my brother and I. And neither my brother or I could sing worth a lick. And she always wanted us to be able to sing because her older brother could sing. And almost throughout her life, when my dad died, my mother was going through this thing, and my dad was a career military, 27 years in the Army, and when she was going through his papers, she found out that he had a special commendation from the commanding officer of Fort Dix, New Jersey, for the way he handled the commissary position and feeding the whole post in Fort Dix, New Jersey, ordering supplies and so on. And when she found that out, you know the first thing she said? I'm going to show that to my brother. Still, wanting the birthright and the blessing. Now, I've been a parent and I've been a child. As a parent, I wanted my 4-year-old daughter to be 21 years old so she'd never embarrass me. Okay? And I laid that on her. I expected too much of her. She was the oldest. Got a little better when we got to the last one. But hey, that was my problem. I'm not perfect. And I had to learn she's not going to be perfect either. A lot of times parents expect too much of kids. But, believe it or not, there's a lot of times kids expect too much of parents. And they get really ticked off when their parents aren't perfect. Or they get really ticked off when their parents don't do this right or don't do that right. What's the whole thing about this birthright stuff?
Hey, what about the forgiveness factor? How do you forgive in your own family? How do you forgive in your own history? And I've seen people and counseled with people in life who get married and in their marriage, they're still trying to get the fathers of another blessing to their spouse. Now, what I'm going to do here is tap into a person that I've just met. I never knew this person before I came here. And we were sitting over at Koinonia last night, and we just had the most beautiful conversation. And I asked him, I said, would you mind getting up and sharing with this group today some of your history, some of your life? Because tomorrow we're going to talk about forgiveness in the family. And if there's no forgiveness in the family, if there's no forgiveness, father to son to father, mother to daughter, mother to son, mother to father, etc., there's destruction in the family. And he agreed to stand up and simply tell you a little bit about his story. Because, you know, there's a real sense in which everybody who's alive wants to tell their story to somebody. I'll venture to say that every person here probably has one person at least that they feel that they can tell their story to, or that they share what's happening in their life. Because we all need to do that. And you know what? Everybody also needs a story to live by. And we're here this weekend because we've chosen a story of Jesus Christ to live by. So, just for a few minutes, Doug, would you share with the group here some of the things that you shared with us?
You guys want to hear my heart? That Ray and a bunch of guys were sitting around the fire and we started talking and they said, well, tell me a little about yourself. And so about 3 hours later, we left. And when we were talking, I touched on a lot of things. And I think one thing is that you guys might be able to relate to is drugs and alcohol. To get caught up in drugs and alcohol, I don't know if it's going around in your school. I have a pretty good idea that it is. And I imagine some of you guys smoke marijuana, have tried it, and some of you guys tried alcohol. I imagine some of you guys, I bet you there's someone in this room today that's got an alcohol problem, that maybe drinks too much, gets out of control at parties. And there might be some guys that smoke a lot of dope. And I was one of those guys. And I'm an alcoholic. Do I look like one? Well, I'm not. I am an alcoholic. And when I was growing up in the family, my dad was an alcoholic. How many people here know someone's an alcoholic or have been associated with alcohol in their life, in their family? Anybody? Okay. How about drugs? Okay. And I was one of those guys. My life was pretty messed up because my dad drank a lot. I really didn't have any acceptance. My father, you know, I didn't feel accepted by my father, so I had to go out and win my acceptance. He was never home. He was always putting me down, drinking with the guys. He was never around. And here I am, 26 years old, finding myself doing the same thing that he was doing. Has anyone ever heard that song, Cats in the Cradle? One night, I was sitting home a couple years ago with my nice guitar, and I was playing the Cats in the Cradle to my mom and my dad. And I started to cry. And I took my guitar and I smashed it over the edge of the couch. That's pain. I was hurting really bad. And deep inside me, there were some things that were stirring up. I didn't know how to deal with them. Usually, I have some pain, I take off, I go down and I drink to avoid the pain. And watching my dad avoid pain all his life until he was 45 years old, he would never face the pain. And here I was doing the exact same thing he was doing. And it took me to totally give myself up to AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's one thing about the AA program that I really like, is that people accept you for who you are. And in the AA program, people, they talk about their problems. You know, I sometimes feel like when I go to church, I can't talk about my problems. People will think that I'm weird or something. Or I go into youth group and I don't want to talk about my problems that I have. But I go to AA and I can talk about my problems, my pain in my life. And people can say, laugh there and smile and say, yeah, I can relate to what you're saying. I've been there. I hurt. I hurt just like that. My dad's an alcoholic. I came from a dysfunctional family. I mean, there could be dysfunctional within. I mean, when I was in high school, I argued with my parents so much. It wasn't even funny. I was talking to a lady this morning about that. And our family was so, it was such a, I couldn't describe it. I didn't want to go home because there was this black cloud that was just hanging over our house, and I had nobody to talk to about that. So, you know, I'm up here, I'm really nervous, but I'm up here to tell you guys that through AA and through friends, I have a really good friend here with me, that I can talk to about these problems I don't have to live in that misery and that pain that I used to. We were taking a walk yesterday with this girl and this good friend of mine, and we came to a creek, and we were just playing a game, and the two guys jumped over the creek, and I didn't jump over the creek. And I said, I don't want to jump over the creek. I want to go live this kind of life. I want to run around. I want to have fun. I want to party. I want to buy nice things. I want to get that instant credit. I want to go out and buy a brand new car and worry about the payments later. I want to live that kind of life. And they were saying, come on, why don't you come across the creek? I said, no, I'm not going to come across that creek. They tried to convince me. They did all they could in their powers to get me over that creek. Well, finally, I decided to go over the creek myself. I decided to jump. And when I jumped, we embraced each other and we hugged each other. And there were a few tears. And I was in a new world. I was in a brand new world. And it was so neat because back behind me on this side of the creek was the dark forest. And on the other side of the creek were the mountains. And it was just beautiful. It was life forever. So thanks to God and to my commitment to God, that I believe in Him, you know, to pull me through these hard times, to stick it out through the hard times. Anybody here a weightlifter? A couple weightlifters? How about athletes? Anybody run? Okay. How about anybody in music? Okay. What does it take to become good in music? Practice. Is it fun to practice? And it's no fun to hurt. It really isn't. I've been avoiding my wife has a guitar. Good thing. And I've been avoiding, I want to learn new chords on my guitar. But I've been avoiding taking the time and the pain to stick it out and get good at it. So with this, I think I'll end.
Mm-hmm.
And
thank you very much, Ted.
Welcome.
I'd like to close with a poem. And the poem is a poem that I wrote. And way back when I was in the fourth grade, in my life, my dad being a career man in the Army, we went from one school to another. I started a new school practically every year of school. And when I was in the fourth grade, I started this new school in Jobstown, New Jersey. And every time I had to start a new school, I was scared. And the best thing for me is starting a new school was just to feel, I just wish I could be invisible. And nobody look at me, nobody ask me any questions or anything like that. So in this fourth grade, guess what happened when I got there? They decided to choose up sides and do some kind of a contest or a game or something like that. What do you think was the first thing that popped into my head? Huh? What? Be chosen last? Is that what somebody said?
Yeah.
You're right on. I sat there and said, oh boy, I'll bet you I'm going to be the last one chosen. And one of the captains was a boy and one of the captains was a girl. This is in the fourth grade. And I'm standing there waiting to be chosen. And they're going back to that to that. People are leaving and I'm still standing there. And holy smokes, I was right. The girl's turn to choose. I'm the last one left. And guess what she said? You take it, we don't want it. You know what I did? I cried. I was totally humiliated. Fourth grade, new at school, and I cried. And what really blew me away back then was a girl made me cry. You know what ticked into my head at that point? You know what I learned from that? 9 years old, I said to myself, anytime you cry, man, you get humiliated. And I never cried in front of anybody else until I was 42 years old when my father died.
because I learned that lesson well.
And then there was a part of the Bible that came alive to me.
It was from the 8th chapter of Romans. In the 8th chapter of Romans, it says, the Spirit of God prays within us with groanings that cannot be uttered. And that is tears. And out of that experience, I wrote a poem that I share with you, and this is a very personal poem for you. So I appreciate your attention. And I've entitled this poem, The Theology of Tears. When I was a child, sensitive, alive, I heard a message. It said, don't cry. A child new at school, tender of age, not chosen, embarrassed, full of rage. The message said, those feelings hide. For if shared, what happens to pride? A pastor to people, angry and hurt, would they understand or simply be curt? What is the risk? What is the price? Too steep for me. I'll try to be nice. Spirit of God, is this message right? Help me to question. Increase my sight. A chaplain to patients in a hospital. New insights to gain. Is it okay for them to share feelings of pain? That don't cry message stays in the head, whether walking or standing or lying in bed. Spirit of God, teach us to pray and help us to share. What do we say? A chaplain in prison, men behind bars, wrenching and hurting, and life all ajar. Feelings of hurt, anger, and rage do abound. The need to scream and sob and cry all around. But all one observes is violence toward each other and an inability to shed tears with one's brother. Spirit of God, how can this be? Is there some way that they too can be free? No words need be uttered, no thought need be muttered. For words are inadequate when part of one dies. Those feelings are best spoken by sobs and by sighs. Can it be that tears are the ultimate prayer, and that he who cries is alive and aware? Lord, help us to share our hurts and our fears as we seek to understand the theology of tears. Please, people, don't be afraid of pain. Don't be afraid of tears. Because we believe in a forgiveness factor. Amen.